Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank, and the Business of Breeding Plants. Jane Smith will join us tomorrow following the 1 o'clock news.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
In sports headlines, the Detroit Red Wings and Chicago Blackhawks are off today before taking the ice in Detroit for Game 5 of their playoff series. The Red Wings hold a 4-1 advantage in the best-of-7 series. Milwaukee pitcher Jeff Subban and St. Louis's Adam Wainwright will face off tonight when the Brewers and the Cardinals continue their 3-game set at Miller Park. The Chicago Cubs, meanwhile, are hoping to end a 9-game slide when they face struggling Pittsburgh pitcher Ian Snell at Wrigley Field tonight. Snell is 1-5 this season. And the Chicago White Sox are hoping for a repeat of last night's 17-3 rout of the Los Angeles Angels when the teams continue their 3-game series on the West Coast tonight. Chicago has won 15 of its last 20 games at Angel Stadium, including 3 playoff wins in the 2005 ALCS en route to a World Series title. That's a look at sports. It's 2:42. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at ways to reduce the number of deaths from prescription painkillers. Millions of Americans take them every day, and accidental overdose deaths are on the rise. West Virginia is a state facing this growing problem. Scott Finn of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports.
In the county courthouse in tiny Pineville, West Virginia, Clerk Michael Good flips through a fat folder of death certificates. Each one represents someone who died of an accidental drug overdose.
58 years old with oxycodone, hydrocodone, lorazepam, 33 years old.
Good, who's also the town's only funeral director, says about 10 years ago, drug abusers began to crush and snort prescription painkillers for a heroin-like high. Some steal the prescription drugs or buy them on the street. In 2007, drug overdoses killed 18 people in Wyoming County, more than car accidents, homicide, and suicide combined.
It's amazing the things that you see that, you know, that causes death of relatively young people that should be still a productive part of society for the next 20 years. If these people had died of the swine flu, we'd probably be making national headlines.
West Virginia has the nation's worst overdose death rate, but it's become a national problem. The number of accidental drug overdoses in the U.S. has doubled from about 11,000 in 1999 to more than 22,000 in 2005. Most of that increase is blamed on prescription painkillers. It's gotten so big, the Food and Drug Administration is taking action. FDA spokeswoman Judy Leon explains.
These drugs will be required to have a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy, or what we call REMS, to ensure that the benefits of the drugs continue to outweigh the risks.
In recent years, FDA officials added black box warnings to fentanyl and methadone and sent educational letters to doctors. But officials now say their previous education efforts have largely failed. In this new REMS plan, the agency could require patients to submit to drug testing or require a pill count where patients must bring to their doctor unused pain medication. It also could require doctors to attend special training or even limit those who can prescribe certain painkillers. And if the drug companies don't go along, the FDA could conceivably pull some of these painkillers off the market. Pain specialist J.K. Lilly says the news has sent shockwaves through his profession.
As far as I know, nobody expected it. The way it came out of nowhere, it was like a bomb out of the blue with a 60-day fuse.
Lilly runs Appalachian Pain Clinic in Charleston. He's worried new restrictions may make life harder for legitimate pain patients. He says since many of the overdoses occur when the drug is used illicitly, it's the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, not the FDA, that should be taking the lead.
I mean, it's not uncommon to see people come in the hospital overdose with grandma's Xanax, my brother-in-law's hydrocodone, and a couple of methadones from somebody that he bought off the street. Those people can get dead real quick. Every one of those drugs that they got were prescription drugs, but they were not provided for them.
While pain doctors worry the FDA may go too far, relatives of overdose victims think the agency may not do enough. Some are calling for an outright ban on certain extended-release painkillers, such as OxyContin, the drug that is now so popular in Appalachia, it's earned the nickname Hillbilly Heroin. For NPR News, I'm Scott Finn in Charleston, West Virginia.
It's 2:45. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. Plenty of parents try to keep their kids out of the kitchen. So if you want a simple explanation of the success of SpongeBob SquarePants, there it is. SpongeBob distracts your child while you're cooking. But food writer Nigella Lawson says the easiest child care option is, in her words, keeping the kid in the kitchen. NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke with Lawson about cooking with children.
I know it sounds odd, and I'm not pretending they ever do anything like help me. You know, people say, have the children helped? I always think, no, I wouldn't put it that way. But the thing is that I feel that they are absorbed and it's creative. But most of all, I mean, it's purely selfish. It's because otherwise I feel obliged to do something like take them out and have a run around or do something like that. And I am incredibly lazy and not at all athletic. So the idea of having to kick a ball about or push them and swings forever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's okay every now and then, but mostly if I can have them in the kitchen stirring something, even if in the end there's a huge tug of war going on over whose turn it is to stir the muffin batter, I'll do it.
I'm just thinking my daughter is four and is just of the age where she's riding a bike, but not old enough that you can let her go on her own, so you end up running a mile behind this kid.
Oh, I know. See, whereas you could just be making some cookies or some bread rolls and she'd love it. In a certain way, cooking is like, you know, playing in, I don't know what you call it, we call it a sandpit, or making mud pies. But I've always found that if children help cook a meal, they tend to eat it. So I find it a very good way of preventing children from getting too fussy and faddy.
So now you've got two kids, right? A boy and a girl?
I've got two and I have a stepdaughter. So very outnumbered.
Everybody's into their teens now or close to it?
Nearly. My son is still 12. I've got about another month before he turns into a monster.
So what are some of the recipes that you can aim at these kids and that you've been able to aim at them over the last several years as they've been younger?
One of the recipes I've been doing since they were very young has been some soft white dinner rolls, because their little hands were so good at forming the rolls, and it really is quite easy for them to sort of see what it is they're making, and they love to do it surprisingly together without fighting too much. And you're not trying to, you know, make them work as a master pâtissier straight away. You're just trying to make bread that you can have for supper. It takes 15 minutes to bake, which is not long. And to be honest, I'm not a Puritan. I'm very happy for them to watch TV while some of the dough rises. I'm very happy to watch TV myself while it rises. If I can get them to do their homework, so much the better. But I'm not trying to, you know, be like the captain in Sound of Music and forbid play and only have whistles. But it's, you know, this is part of play.
Actually, our colleague here at NPR, Courtney Dorning, has made some of these soft white dinner rolls. Do you mind, Nigella Lawson, if I just, you know, grabbed a bite of that and ask about another recipe here, which has a great name, Cheesy Feet.
Cheesy Feet, I know. Only, but children like things that are rather disgusting. I think if you said to an adult, can I offer you a cheesy foot? They might say, are you mad?
Sorry, but I have two of those already, thank you.
You know, so, but Cheesy Feet happened because I have a collection of cookie cutters. And, of course, the thing about a collection means that you can never stop. And a friend of mine brought me this set of feet. Mm-hmm. There's a very kind of old-fashioned English recipe, which is called cheese straws. And I thought, well, that surely would work in a sense for my feet. And I had to do cheesy feet. And that's an incredibly easy recipe because I use a food processor. And I don't mind the children using that as long as they don't touch the blade, because, of course, when it's on, the lid has to be on safely so they can't actually hurt themselves.
Yeah.
And it's simply 1.5 cups of grated cheddar cheese, and 1.5 tablespoons of soft butter, 1/3 cup of all-purpose flour, and 1/4 teaspoonful of baking powder. And that's it. You just put everything in together and just blitz it until the dough comes together. You think it won't at first, but it does. And then just take it out, and that's really the grown-up's job. And I sort of make a fat disc,
yeah.
wrap it in plastic wrap, and put it in the fridge for about 15 minutes. And then you just roll it out, and it's a very forgiving dough. And then they can cut out many feet and then re-roll all the scraps and make more feet. And out of this, which is, after all, not a huge amount, you've got about 16 feet of varying sizes.
You've got a photograph in one of your books here of
yes,
a bunch of feet.
Yes, walking down the table.
It looks like somebody's following the trail of Sasquatch there. Very nice.
But actually, if you wanted to amuse your grown-up friends, I would put some cayenne pepper in them. I think it would be really uncharitable to do that if you're expecting children to eat them.
Are you trying, as you bring your kids into the kitchen and as you encourage them to cook with you, are you trying to teach them anything about how to eat or how to think about food?
I try and teach in the way that my mother taught me, which is not to teach, but for them to see. My father always generally says, you know, children learn from example, not from precept. And I think that is true the whole of life. So I would give them a pair of scissors to top and tail some beans, or sometimes ask them to stir a pan. So I do that. And then more recently, what I've been doing is trying to make each child make supper one night a week. I have to say it doesn't always work, but that's how I started off. And rather than getting them to do a different thing each day, say my daughter had Monday, I tried for each month stick to the same recipe, because that way, by the end of the month, you will know it.
Has there been anybody, an adult, who showed up and then discovered that your 12-year-old cooked dinner?
No, but I have much worse. As you know, children are embarrassed about their parents.
Oh, of course.
And because of that, when I often have a house full of children, teenagers, at the weekend, and I am not allowed to cook for them. Because my children say, it's too embarrassing, Mum.
So rather than many parents who might ban their kids from the kitchen when they're cooking, you've actually been banned from your own
yes,
kitchen by your
but
kids.
Also, exactly, and I did once, my son once came back from somewhere and he said they'd had something out of a tin. No offence, Mum, but it was so much better than anything you've ever cooked.
Well, Nigella Lawson, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Lovely to talk to you.
Nigella Lawson talking with Steve Inskeep. This year, even a college degree is no guarantee of a job, as commentator Emma Jacobs of Youth Radio has learned. In the past, many students had a position lined up before the end of senior year. Jacobs graduated from Columbia last week with a history degree, but no job.
My job search began nearly 4 months ago. I've sent out dozens of cover letters and applications, mainly for jobs without prerequisites. A history major like me doesn't come with many specialized skills besides research. These days, it's difficult to convince people to take a chance on an entry-level hire.
Hi, Ryan. Is this... this is Emma Jacobs.
That's me, on one of the handful of interviews I eventually landed, but still no job. There was 1 week when I got 3 rejections. It felt like I'd hit a brick wall. I'm not questioning my abilities, but I have begun questioning my choices, knowing students with engineering degrees are still finding jobs. And many of the positions I am equipped to fill are disappearing. Alex Kaz is another new graduate without a job. He majored in physics and has been applying for teaching jobs like Teach for America, which usually hires recent graduates. This year, competition is tougher.
We had like the one-day interviews, and that's when everyone comes in. So many other people were laid off. A lot of people were, former bankers, lawyers, attorneys, etc. You could see that clearly this was not their first like career choice. And many of them, you know, worked on Wall Street for X number of years or worked in a law firm or, you know, marketing, I don't know, whatever. And they were sitting amongst us in a program that was originally geared towards people who were leaving college and trying to get them to come to the classroom.
Now Alex is feeling a bit lost. So am I. After all our hard work, it's difficult to face the reality of a big blank space now that we've finally graduated. I'm not devastated, but I'm exhausted. Before graduation, my father kept asking if he should bring the car to take my things back to Boston. I wasn't sure how to answer. If I found a job, I wouldn't have to move home. So I just said I don't know. At least I can commiserate with my friend Avigail Oren about our job searches. We give each other pep talks. At this stage of the game, it's all about shifting our expectations.
I would hate to say that I'd take any job. I definitely have had to rethink. I started out looking for jobs that paid $30,000 to $40,000, and now I'm looking definitely from 20 to 30. And I would say, though, that it's been difficult. Hurry up and waiting. You know, oh, get you. We want to get you in for an interview right away, right away. You hustle in. 2 weeks later, you're sending follow-up emails saying, are you still alive? You know, hello.
I've been there. At one small nonprofit, the hiring manager told me up front that other applicants had master's degrees and years of work experience. Abigail says she gets it.
Ultimately, I am a new entry into the job market, despite all of my unpaid internship experience, despite all of my volunteer work and activities. I've never gone into an office at 9 o'clock and walked out at 5.
And for us, it may be a while longer until the 9-to-5 job materializes. I finally decided to take one more unpaid internship and stay in New York for as long as I can afford it. I'll have to get temp jobs to pay the rent, but at least when my father asks about my plans, I can tell him not to bring the car.
Emma Jacobs, she is a recent graduate of Columbia University. She graduated last week with a degree in history.
Earth and Sky.
So I think that the public opinion of nuclear energy has been steadily increasing for the last decade. And one of the major reasons for that is concern about global climate change and the recognition that nuclear energy has a big role to play in mitigating and reducing the amount of greenhouse gases we emit.
You're listening to Paul Wilson, nuclear scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Wilson is one scientist who believes that nuclear power is a proven means to supply the growing demand for clean energy.
I think we need to have nuclear energy as a big option in our energy future because it has no direct emissions of greenhouse gases.
Wilson said he believes that what nuclear power plants do emit, spent nuclear fuel, is compact and contained.
Spent nuclear fuel stays where you put it. You can put it somewhere and you can watch it and you can keep it there without very much effort whatsoever.
We asked Wilson about the concern that more nuclear energy would mean more nuclear weapons.
Most commercial nuclear power systems are very difficult to turn into military nuclear power systems. And so there's a lot of different techniques we can use to avoid that.
He said those techniques include both advanced technology and political diplomacy. For more on both sides of the nuclear issue, come to our website. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com.
It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock, 77 degrees in Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up next, it's The World from PRI. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 5.